The party's tomorrow in Rifthold, if you feel like reliving the good old days, Prince. Oh, the general knew exactly what buttons to push, and he didn't give a damn what a mess it made. It made him dangerous. Deadly. Especially where Dorian and his magic were concerned. Kaol forced himself to say goodnight to some of his men, to look casual and unconcerned as they walked from the dining hall. Adian Ashriver had come to Rifthold, narrowly missing running into his long-lost cousin. If Adian knew Aelin was still alive, if he knew who and what she had become, or what she had learned regarding the king's secret power, would he stand with her, or destroy her? Given his actions, given the ring he bore, Kaol didn't want the general anywhere near her, anywhere near Terrasen either. He wondered how much blood would spill when Selaena learned what her cousin had done. Kaol and Dorian walked in silence for most of the trek to the prince's tower. When they turned down an empty hallway and were certain no one could overhear them, Dorian said,
"I didn't need you to step in."
"Adian's a bastard," Kaol growled.
The conversation could end there, and part of him was tempted to let it, but he made himself say,
"I was worried you'd snap, like you did in the passages."
He loosed a tight breath.
"Are you stable?"
"Some days are better than others. Getting angry or frightened seems to set it off."
They entered the hallway that ended in the arched wooden door to Dorian's tower. But Kaol stopped him with an arm on his shoulder.
"I don't want details,"
he murmured, so the guards posted outside Dorian's door couldn't hear.
"Because I don't want my knowledge used against you. I know I've made mistakes, Dorian. Believe me, I know. But my priority has always been, and still is, keeping you protected."
Dorian stared at him for a long moment, cocking his head to the side. Kaol must have looked as miserable as he felt, because the prince's voice was almost gentle as he said,
"Why did you really send her to Wendlin?"
Agony punched through him, raw and razor-edged. But as much as he yearned to tell the prince about Selaena, as much as he wanted to unload all his secrets so it would fill the hole in his core, he couldn't. So he just said,
"I sent her to do what needs to be done,"
and strode back down the hall. Dorian didn't call after him. Chapter 4. Manon pulled her blood-red cloak tightly around herself and pressed into the shadows of the closet, listening to the three men who had broken into her cottage. She'd tasted the rising fear and rage on the wind all day, and had spent the afternoon preparing. She'd been sitting on the thatched roof of the whitewashed cottage when she spotted their torches bobbing over the high grasses of the field. None of the villagers had tried to stop the three men, though none had joined them either. A Crokin witch had come to their little green valley in the north of Fenharrow, they'd said. In the weeks that she'd been living amongst them, carving out a miserable existence, she'd been waiting for this night. It was the same at every village she'd lived in or visited. She held her breath, keeping still as a deer as one of the men, a tall, bearded farmer with hands the size of dinner plates, stepped into her bedroom. Even from the closet she could smell the ale on his breath, and the bloodlust. Oh, the villagers knew exactly what they planned to do with the witch who sold potions and charms from her back door, and who could predict the sex of a babe before it was due. She was surprised it had taken these men so long to work up the nerve to come here, to torment and then destroy what petrified them. The farmer stopped in the middle of the room.
"We know you're here,"
he coaxed, even as he stepped toward the bed,
scanning every inch of the room.
We just want to talk. Some of the townsfolk are spooked, you see. More scared of you than you are of them, I bet.
She knew better than to listen, especially as a dagger glinted behind his back while he peered under the bed. Always the same, at every backwater town and uptight mortal village. As the man straightened, Manon slipped from the closet and into the darkness behind the bedroom door. Muffled clinking and thudding told her enough about what the other two men were doing. Not just looking for her, but stealing whatever they wanted. There wasn't much to take. The cottage had already been furnished when she'd arrived, and all her belongings, by training and instinct, were in a sack in the corner of the closet she'd just vacated. Take nothing with you. Leave nothing behind.
We just want to talk, witch.
The man turned from the bed, finally noticing the closet. He smiled, in triumph, in anticipation. With gentle fingers, Manon eased the bedroom door shut, so quietly the man didn't notice as he headed for the closet. She'd oiled the hinges on every door in this house. His massive hand gripped the closet doorknob, dagger now angled at his side.
"Come out, little Kraken," he crooned.
Silent as death, Manon slid up behind him. The fool didn't even know she was there until she brought her mouth close to his ear and whispered,
"Wrong kind of witch."
The man whirled, slamming into the closet door. He raised the dagger between them, his chest heaving. Manon merely smiled, her silver-white hair glinting in the moonlight. He noticed the shut door then, drawing in breath to shout. But Manon smiled broader, and a row of dagger-sharp iron teeth pushed from the slits high in her gums, snapping down like armor. The man started, hitting the door behind him again, eyes so wide that white shone all around them. His dagger clattered on the floorboards. And then, just to really make him soil his pants, she flicked her wrists in the air between them. The iron claws shot over her nails in a stinging, gleaming flash. The man began whispering a plea to his soft-hearted gods as Manon let him back toward the lone window. Let him think he stood a chance while she stalked toward him, still smiling. The man didn't even scream before she ripped out his throat. When she was done with him, she slipped through the bedroom door. The two men were still looting, still believing that all of this belonged to her. It had been merely an abandoned house, its previous owners dead or smart enough to leave this festering place. The second man also didn't get a chance to scream before she gutted him with two swipes of her iron nails. But the third farmer came looking for his companions, and when he beheld her standing there, one hand twisted in his friend's insides, the other holding him to her as she used her iron teeth to tear out his throat, he ran. The common watery taste of the man, laced with violence and fear, coated her tongue, and she spat onto the wooden floorboards. But Manon didn't bother wiping away the blood slipping down her chin, as she gave the remaining farmer a head start into the field of towering winter grass, so high that it was well over their heads. She counted to 10, because she wanted to hunt, and had been that way since she tore through her mother's womb and came roaring and bloody into this world. Because she was Manon Blackbeak, heir to the Blackbeak Witch Clan, and she had been here for weeks, pretending to be a Kraken witch in the hope that it would flush out the real ones. They were still out there, the self-righteous, insufferable Krakens, hiding as healers and wise women. Her first glorious kill had been a Kraken, no more than 16, the same age as Manon at the time. The dark-haired girl had been wearing the blood-red cloak that all Krakens were gifted upon their first bleeding, and the only good it had done was mark her as prey.
After Manon left the Kraken's corpse in that snow-blasted mountain pass, she'd taken the cloak as a trophy, and still wore it over 100 years later. No other Iron Teeth witch could have done it, because no other Iron Teeth witch would have dared incur the wrath of the three matrons by wearing their eternal enemy's color. But from the day Manon stalked into Blackbeak Keep wearing the cloak and holding that Kraken heart in a box, a gift for her grandmother, it had been her sacred duty to hunt them down, one by one, until there were none left. This was her latest rotation. 6 months in Fenharrow while the rest of her coven was spread through Melisande and Northern Eelway under similar orders. But in the months that she'd prowled from village to village, she hadn't discovered a single Kraken. These farmers were the first bit of fun she'd had in weeks, and she would be damned if she didn't enjoy it. Manon walked into the field, sucking the blood off her nails as she went. She slipped through the grasses, no more than shadow and mist. She found the farmer lost in the middle of the field, softly bleeding with fear. And when he turned, his bladder loosening at the sight of the blood and the iron teeth and the wicked, wicked smile, Manon let him scream all he wanted. Chapter 5. Selena and Rowan rode down the dusty road that meandered between the boulder-spotted grasslands and into the southern foothills. She'd memorized enough maps of Wendland to know that they'd pass through them, and then over the towering Cambrian Mountains that marked the border between mortal-ruled Wendland and the immortal lands of Queen Maeve. The sun was setting as they ascended the foothills, the road growing rockier, bordered on one side by rather harrowing ravines. For a mile, she debated asking Rowan where he planned to stop for the night, but she was tired. Not just from the day, or the wine, or the riding. In her bones, in her blood and breath and soul, she was so, so tired. Talking to anyone was too taxing, which made Rowan the perfect companion. He didn't say a single word to her. Twilight fell as the road brought them through a dense forest that spread into and over the mountains, the trees turning from cypress to oak. From narrow to tall and proud, full of thickets and scattered mossy boulders. Even in the growing dark, the forest seemed to be breathing. The warm air hummed, leaving a metallic taste coating her tongue. Far behind them, thunder grumbled. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Especially since Rowan was finally dismounting to make camp. From the look of his saddlebags, he didn't have a tent, or bedrolls, or blankets. Perhaps it was now fair to assume that her visit with Maeve wasn't to be pleasant. Neither of them spoke as they led their horses into the trees, just far enough off the road to be hidden from any passing travelers. Dumping their gear at the camp he'd selected, Rowan brought his mare to a nearby stream he must have heard with those pointed ears. He didn't falter one step in the growing dark, though Selena certainly stubbed her toes against a few rocks and roots. Excellent eyesight, even in the dark. Another fey trait. One she could have if she... No, she wasn't going to think about that. Not after what had happened on the other side of that portal. She'd shifted then, and it had been awful enough to remind her that she had no interest in ever doing it again. After the horses drank, Rowan didn't wait for her as he took both mares back to the camp. She used the privacy to see to her own needs, then dropped to her knees on the grassy bank and drank her fill of the stream. Gods, the water tasted new and ancient and powerful and delicious. She drank until she understood the hole in her belly might very well be from hunger, then staggered back to the camp, finding it by the gleam of Rowan's silver hair.
He wordlessly handed her some bread and cheese, then returned to rubbing down the horses. She muttered a thank you, but didn't bother offering to help as she plunked down against a towering oak. When her belly had stopped hurting so much, and she realized just how loudly she'd been munching on the apple he'd also tossed her while feeding the horses, she mustered enough energy to say, "Are there so many threats in Wendland that we can't risk a fire?" He sat against a tree and stretched his legs, crossing his ankles.
"Not from mortals,"
his first words to her since they'd left the city. It could have been an attempt to spook her, but she still did a mental inventory of all the weapons she carried. She wouldn't ask. Didn't want to know what manner of thing might crawl toward a fire. The tangle of wood and moss and stone loomed, full of the rustling of heavy leaves, the gurgling of the swollen brook, the flapping of feathered wings. And there, lurking over the rim of a nearby boulder, were three sets of small, glowing eyes. The hilt of her dagger was in her palm a heartbeat later. But they just stared at her. Rowan didn't seem to notice. He only leaned his head against the oak trunk. They had always known her, the little folk. Even when Otterlin's shadow had covered the continent, they still recognized what she was. Small gifts left at campsites. A fresh fish, a leaf full of blackberries, a crown of flowers. She'd ignored them, and stayed out of Oakwald Forest as much as she could. The fairies kept their unblinking vigil. Wishing she hadn't downed the food so quickly, Selena watched them back, ready to spring to a defensive position. Rowan hadn't moved. What ancient oaths the fairies honored in Terrasen might be disregarded here. Even as she thought it, more eyes glowed between the trees, more silent witnesses to her arrival. Because Selena was fey, or something like a mongrel. Her great-grandmother had been Maeve's sister, proclaimed a goddess when she died. Ridiculous, really. Mab had been very much mortal when she tied her life to the human prince who loved her so fiercely. She wondered how much these creatures knew about the wars that had destroyed her land, about the fey and fairies that had been hunted down, about the burning of the ancient forests and the butchering of the sacred stags of Terrasen. She wondered if they had ever learned what became of their brethren in the West. She didn't know how she found it in herself to care, but they seemed so curious. Surprising even herself, Selena whispered into the humming night, "They still live." All those eyes vanished. When she glanced at Rowan, he hadn't opened his eyes. But she had the sense that the warrior had been aware the entire time. Chapter 6 Dorian Havilliard stood before his father's breakfast table, his hands held behind his back. The king had arrived moments ago but hadn't told him to sit. Once Dorian might have already said something about it. But having magic, getting drawn into whatever mess Selena was in, seeing that other world in the secret tunnels, all of that had changed everything. The best he could do these days was maintain a low profile, to keep his father or anyone else from looking too long in his direction. So Dorian stood before the table and waited. The King of Otterlin finished off the roast chicken and sipped from whatever was in his blood-red glass.
"You're quiet this morning, Prince."
The conqueror of Aurelia reached for a platter of smoked fish.
"I was waiting for you to speak, Father."
Night-black eyes shifted toward him.
"Unusual indeed."
Dorian tensed. Only Selena and Kaol knew the truth about his magic, and Kaol had shut him out so completely that Dorian didn't feel like attempting to explain himself to his friend. But this castle was full of spies and sycophants who wanted nothing more than to use whatever knowledge they could to advance their position, including selling out their crown prince. Who knew who'd seen him in the hallways or the library, or who had discovered that stack of books he'd hidden in Selena's rooms? He'd since moved them down to the tomb, where he went every other night, not for answers to the questions that plagued him, but just for an hour of pure silence. His father resumed eating. He'd been in his father's private chambers only a few times in his life. They could be a manor house of their own, with their library and dining room and council chamber. They occupied an entire wing of the glass castle, a wing opposite from Dorian's mother. His parents had never shared a bed, and he didn't particularly want to know more than that. He found his father watching him, the morning sun through the curved wall of glass making every scar and nick on the king's face even more gruesome.
"You're to entertain Adian Ashriver today."
Dorian kept his composure as best he could.
"Dare I ask why?"
"Since General Ashriver failed to bring his men here, it appears he has some spare time while awaiting the Bane's arrival. It would be beneficial to you both to become better acquainted, especially when your choice of friends of late has been so common."
The cold fury of his magic climbed its way up his spine.
"With all due respect, Father, I have two meetings to prepare for, and..."
"It's not open for debate."
His father kept eating.
"General Ashriver has been notified, and you will meet him outside your chambers at noon."
Dorian knew he should keep quiet, but he found himself asking,
"Why do you tolerate Adian? Why keep him alive? Why make him a general?"
He'd been unable to stop wondering about it since the man's arrival. His father gave a small, knowing smile.
"Because Adian's rage is a useful blade, and he is capable of keeping his people in line. He will not risk their slaughter, not when he has lost so much. He has quelled many a would-be rebellion in the north from that fear, for he is well aware that it would be his own people, the civilians, who suffered first."
He shared blood with a man this cruel.
But Dorian said,
"It's still surprising that you'd keep a general almost as a captive, as little more than a slave. Controlling him through fear alone seems potentially dangerous."
Indeed, he wondered if his father had told Adian about Selena's mission to Wendlin, homeland of Adian's royal bloodline, where Adian's cousins, the Ashrivers, still ruled. Though Adian trumpeted about his various victories over rebels and acted like he practically owned half the empire himself, how much did Adian remember of his kin across the sea? His father said,
"I have my ways of leashing Adian should I need to. For now, his brazen irreverence amuses me."
His father jerked his chin toward the door.
"I will not be amused, however, if you miss your appointment with him today."
And just like that, his father fed him to the wolf. Despite Dorian's offers to show Adian the menagerie, the kennels, the stables, even the damned library, the general only wanted to do one thing: walk through the gardens. Adian claimed he was feeling restless and sluggish from too much food the night before, but the smile he gave Dorian suggested otherwise. Adian didn't bother talking to him, too preoccupied with humming bawdy tunes and inspecting the various women they passed. He'd dropped the half-civilized veneer only once, when they'd been striding down a narrow path flanked by towering rose bushes, stunning in the summer, but deadly in the winter. And the guards had been a turn behind, blind for the moment. Just enough time for Adian to subtly trip Dorian into one of the thorny walls, still humming his lewd songs. A quick maneuver had kept Dorian from falling face first into the thorns, but his cloak had ripped, and his hand stung. Rather than give the general the satisfaction of seeing him hiss and inspect his cuts, Dorian had tucked his barking, freezing fingers into his pockets as the guards rounded the corner. They only spoke when Adian paused by a fountain and braced his scarred hands on his hips, assessing the garden beyond as though it were a battlefield. Adian smirked at the six guards lurking behind, his eyes bright. So bright, Dorian thought, and so strangely familiar, as the general said, "A prince needs an escort in his own palace. I'm insulted they didn't send more guards to protect you from me." "You think you could take six men?" The wolf had let out a low chuckle and shrugged, the scarred hilt of the sword of Orinth catching the near-blinding sunlight. "I don't think I should tell you, in case your father ever decides my usefulness is not worth my temperament." Some of the guards behind them murmured, but Dorian said, "Probably not." And that was it. That was all Adian said to him for the rest of the cold, miserable walk, until the general gave him an edged smile and said, "Better get that looked at." That was when Dorian realized his right hand was still bleeding. Adian just turned away. "Thanks for the walk, Prince," the general said over his shoulder, and it felt more like a threat than anything. Adian didn't act without a reason. Perhaps the general had convinced his father to force this excursion. But for what purpose, Dorian couldn't grasp. Unless Adian merely wanted to get a feel for what sort of man Dorian had become, and how well Dorian could play the game. He wouldn't put it past the warrior to have done it just to assess a potential ally or threat. Adian, for all his arrogance, had a cunning mind. He probably viewed court life as another sort of battlefield. Dorian let Kaol's hand-selected guards lead him back into the wonderfully warm castle, then dismissed them with a nod. Kaol hadn't come today, and he was grateful. After that conversation about his magic, after Kaol refused to speak about Selena, Dorian wasn't sure what else was left for them to talk about. He didn't believe for one moment that Kaol would willingly sanction the deaths of innocent men, no matter whether they were friends or enemies. Kaol had to know, then, that Selena wouldn't assassinate the Ash River royals, for whatever reasons of her own. But there was no point in bothering to talk to Kaol, not when his friend was keeping secrets, too. Dorian mulled over his friend's puzzle box of words again, as he walked into the healer's catacombs, the smell of rosemary and mint wafting past. It was a warren of supply and examination rooms, kept far from the prying eyes of the glass castle high above. There was another ward high in the glass castle for those who wouldn't deign to make the trek down here, but this was where the best healers in Rifthold and Otterlin had honed and practiced their craft for 1,000 years. The pale stones seemed to breathe the essence of centuries of drying herbs, giving the subterranean halls a pleasant, open feeling. Dorian found a small workroom where a young woman was hunched over a large oak table. A variety of glass jars, scales, mortars, and pestles before her, along with vials of liquid, hanging herbs, and bubbling pots over small, solitary flames. The healing arts were one of the few that his father hadn't completely outlawed 10 years ago. Though once, he'd heard, they'd been even more powerful. Once, healers had used magic to mend and save. Now they were left with whatever nature provided them. Dorian stepped into the room, and the young woman looked up from the book she was scanning. a finger pausing on the page. Not beautiful, but pretty. Clean, elegant lines, chestnut hair woven in a braid, and golden tan skin that suggested at least one family member came from Ilway. Can I... She got a good look at him then, and dropped into a bow.
Your Highness, she said,
a flush creeping up the smooth column of her neck. Dorian held up his bloodied hand.
Thornbush.
Rosebush made his cut seem that much more pathetic. She kept her eyes averted, biting her full bottom lip.
Of course.
She gestured a slender hand toward the wooden chair before the table.
Please, unless you'd rather go to a proper examination room.
Dorian normally hated dealing with the stammering and scrambling, but this young woman was still so red, so soft-spoken, that he said, "This is fine," and slid into the chair. The silence lay heavy on him as she hurried through the workroom, first changing her dirty white apron, then washing her hands for a good long minute, then gathering all manner of bandages and tins of salve, then a bowl of hot water and clean rags, and then finally pulling a chair around the table to face his. They didn't speak either when she carefully washed and then examined his hand. But he found himself watching her hazel eyes, the sureness of her fingers, and the blush that remained on her neck and face.
The hand is very complex,
she murmured at last, studying the cuts.
I just wanted to make sure that nothing was damaged and that there weren't any thorns lodged in there.
She swiftly added,
Your Highness.
I think it looks worse than it actually is.
With a feather-light touch, she smeared a cloudy salve on his hand, and like a damn fool, he winced.
Sorry,
she mumbled.
It's to disinfect the cuts, just in case.
She seemed to curl in on herself, as if he'd give the order to hang her merely for that. He fumbled for the words, then said,
I've dealt with worse.
It sounded stupid coming out, and she paused for a moment before reaching for the bandages.
I know,
she said, and glanced up at him. Well, damn, weren't those eyes just stunning? She quickly looked back down, gently wrapping his hand.
I'm assigned to the southern wing of the castle, and I'm often on night duty.
That explained why she looked so familiar. She'd healed not only him that night a month ago, but also Selena, Kaol, Fleetfoot, had been there for all of their injuries these past 7 months.
I'm sorry, I can't remember your name.
It's Sorsha,
she said, though there was no anger in it, as there should have been. The spoiled prince and his entitled friends, too absorbed in their own lives to bother learning the name of the healer who had patched them up again and again. She finished wrapping his hand, and he said,
In case we didn't say it often enough, thank you.
Those green-flecked brown eyes lifted again, a tentative smile.
It's an honor, Prince.
She began gathering up her supplies. Taking that as his cue to leave, he stood and flexed his fingers.
Feels good.
They're minor wounds, but keep an eye on them.
Sorsha dumped the bloodied water down the sink in the back of the room.
And you needn't come all the way down here the next time. Just send word, Your Highness. We're happy to attend to you.
She curtsied low, with the long-limbed grace of a dancer.
You've been responsible for the Southern Stone Wing all this time?
The question within the question was clear enough. You've seen everything? Every inexplicable injury?
We keep records of our patients,
Sorsha said softly, so no one else passing by the open doorway could hear.
But sometimes we forget to write down everything.
She hadn't told anyone what she'd seen. The things that didn't add up.
Dorian gave her a swift bow of thanks and strode from the room. How many others, he wondered, had seen more than they let on? He didn't want to know.
Sorsha's fingers, thankfully, had stopped shaking by the time the Crown Prince left the catacombs. By some lingering grace of Silba, goddess of healers and bringer of peace, and gentle deaths, she'd managed to keep them from trembling while she patched up his hand, too. Sorsha leaned against the counter and loosed a long breath. The cuts hadn't merited a bandage, but she'd been selfish and foolish, and had wanted to keep the beautiful prince in that chair for as long as she could manage. He didn't even know who she was. She'd been appointed full healer a year ago, and had been called to attend to the prince, the captain, and their friend countless times. And the crown prince still had no idea who she was. She hadn't lied to him about failing to keep records of everything. But she remembered it all, especially that night a month ago, when the three of them had been bloodied up and filthy, the girl's hound injured too, with no explanation and no one raising a fuss, and the girl, their friend, the king's champion, that's who she was. Lover, it seemed, of both the prince and his captain at one time or another. Sorsha had helped Amethy tend to the young woman after the brutal duel to win her title. Occasionally, she'd checked on the girl and found the prince holding her in bed. She'd pretended it didn't matter, because the crown prince was notorious where women were involved. But it hadn't stopped the sinking ache in her chest. Then things had changed, and when the girl was poisoned with chlorella, it was the captain who stayed with her. The captain who had acted like a beast in a cage, prowling the room until Sorsha's own nerves had been frayed. Not surprisingly, several weeks later, the girl's handmaid, Philippa, came to Sorsha for a contraceptive tonic. Philippa hadn't said whom it was for, but Sorsha wasn't an idiot. When she'd attended the captain a week after that, 4 brutal scratches down his face and a dead look in his eyes. Sorsha had understood. And understood again the last time, when the prince, the captain, and the girl were all bloodied along with the hound, that whatever had existed between the three of them was broken. The girl especially. Selena, she'd heard them say accidentally when they thought she was already out of the room. Selena Sardothian, world's greatest assassin, and now the king's champion. Another secret Sorsha would keep without them ever knowing. She was invisible, and glad of it most days. Sorsha frowned at her table of supplies. She had 6 tonics and poultices to make before dinner, all of them complex, all of them dumped on her by Amethy, who pulled rank whenever she could. On top of it, she still had her weekly letter to write to her friend, who wanted every little detail about the palace. Just thinking of all the tasks gave her a headache. Had it been anyone other than the prince, she would have told them to go find another healer. Sorsha returned to her work. She was certain he'd forgotten her name the moment he left. Dorian was heir to the mightiest empire in the world, and Sorsha was the daughter of 2 dead immigrants from a village in Fenharrow that had been burned to ash, a village that no one would ever remember. But that didn't stop her from loving him, as she still did, invisible and secret, ever since she'd first laid eyes on him 6 years ago. Chapter 7. Nothing else approached Selena and Rowan after that first night. He certainly didn't say anything to her about it, or offer his cloak or any sort of protection against the chill. She slept curled on her side, turning every other minute from some root or pebble digging into her back, or jolting awake at the screech of an owl, or something worse. By the time the light had turned gray and mist drifted through the trees, Selena felt more exhausted than she'd been the night before. After a silent breakfast of bread, cheese, and apples, she was nearly dozing atop her mare as they resumed their ride up the forested foothill road. They passed few people, mostly humans leading wagons down to some market, all of whom glanced at Rowan and gave them the right of way. Some even muttered prayers for mercy. She'd long heard the Fae existed peacefully with the humans in Wendlin, so perhaps the terror they encountered was due to Rowan himself. The tattoo didn't help. She had debated asking him what the words meant, but that would involve talking, and talking meant building some sort of relationship. She'd had enough of friends. Enough of them dying, too. So she'd kept her mouth shut the entire day they rode through the woods up into the Cambrian Mountains. The forest turned lusher and denser, and the higher they rode, the mistier it became. Great veils of fog drifting past to caress her face, her neck, her spine. Another cold, miserable night camped off the road later, and they were riding again before dawn. By then, the mist had seeped into her clothes and skin and settled right along her bones. On the third evening, she'd given up hoping for a fire. She'd even embraced the chill and the insufferable roots, and the hunger whose edge she couldn't dull no matter how much bread and cheese she ate. The aches and pains were soothing somehow. Not comforting, but distracting. Welcome. Deserved. She didn't want to know what that meant about her. She couldn't let herself look that far inward. She'd come close that day she'd seen Prince Galen, and it had been enough. They veered from the path in the dwindling afternoon hours, cutting across mossy earth that cushioned each step. She hadn't seen a town in days, and the granite boulders were now carved with whorls and patterns. She supposed they were markers, a warning to humans to stay the hell away. They had to be another week from Doranel, but Rowan was heading along the mountains, not over them, climbing higher still, the ascent broken by occasional plateaus and fields of wildflowers. She hadn't seen a lookout, so she had no sense of where they were or how high. Just the endless forest, and the endless climb, and the endless mist. She smelled smoke before she saw the lights. Not campfires, but lights from a building rising up out of the trees, hugging the spine of the mountain slope. The stones were dark and ancient, hewn from something other than the abundant granite. Her eyes strained, but she didn't fail to notice the ring of towering rocks woven between the trees, surrounding the entirety of the fortress. It was hard not to notice them when they rode between two megaliths that curved toward each other, like the horns of a great beast, and a zinging current snapped against her skin. Wards. Magic wards. Her stomach turned. If they didn't keep out enemies, they certainly served as an alarm. Which meant the three figures patrolling each of the three towers, the six on the outer retaining wall, and the three at the wooden gates, would now know they were approaching. Men and women in light leather armor and bearing swords, daggers, and bows monitored their approach. "I think I'd rather stay in the woods," she said. Her first words in days. Rowan ignored her. He didn't even lift an arm in greeting to the sentries. He must be familiar with this place if he didn't stoop to hellos. As they drew closer to the ancient fortress, which was little more than a few watchtowers woven together by a large connecting building, splattered with lichen and moss, she did the calculations. It had to be some border outpost, a halfway point between the mortal realm and Doranel. Perhaps she'd finally have a warm place to sleep, even if just for the night. The guards saluted Rowan, who didn't spare them a passing glance. They all wore hoods, masking any signs of their heritage. Were they Fae? Rowan might not have spoken to her for most of their journey. He'd shown as much interest in her as he would in a pile of shit on the road. But if she were staying with the Fae, others might have questions. She took in every detail, every exit, every weakness as they entered the large courtyard beyond the wall. Two rather mortal-looking stable hands rushing to help them dismount. It was so still. As if everything, even the stones, was holding its breath. As if it had been waiting. The sensation only worsened when Rowan wordlessly led her into the dim interior of the main building, up a narrow set of stone stairs, and into what looked to be a small office. It wasn't the carved oak furniture, or the faded green drapes, or the warmth of the fire that made her stop dead. It was the dark-haired woman seated behind the desk. Maeve, Queen of the Fae. Her aunt. And then came the words she had been dreading for 10 years. Hello, Aelin Galathinius.
Chapter 8. Selena backed away, knowing exactly how many steps it would take to get into the hall, but slammed into a hard, unyielding body just as the door shut behind them. Her hands were shaking so badly she didn't bother going for her weapons, or Rowan's. He'd cut her down the instant Maeve gave the order. The blood rushed from Selena's head. She forced herself to take a breath. And another. Then she said in a too quiet voice, Aelin Galathinius is dead. Just speaking her name aloud, the damned name she had dreaded and hated and tried to forget. Maeve smiled, revealing sharp little canines. Let us not bother with lies. It wasn't a lie. That girl, that princess, had died in a river a decade ago. Selena was no more Aelin Galathinius than she was any other person. The room was too hot, too small. Rowan, a brooding force of nature, behind her. She was not to have time to gather herself, to make up excuses and half-truths, as she should have been doing these past few days instead of free-falling into silence and the misty cold. She was to face the Queen of the Fae as Maeve wanted to be faced, and in some fortress that seemed far, far beneath the raven-haired beauty watching her with black, depthless eyes. Gods. Gods! Maeve was fearsome in her perfection. Utterly still, eternal and calm and radiating ancient grace. The dark sister to the fair-haired Mab. Selena had been fooling herself into thinking this would be easy. She was still pressed against Rowan as though he were a wall. An impenetrable wall, as old as the wardstones surrounding the fortress. Rowan stepped away from her with his powerful predatory ease and leaned against the door. She wasn't getting out until Maeve allowed her. The Queen of the Fae remained silent, her long fingers moon-white and folded in the lap of her violet gown. A white barn owl perched on the back of her chair. She didn't bother with a crown, and Selena supposed she didn't need one. Every creature on Earth would know who she was, what she was, even if they were blind and deaf. Maeve, the face of 1,000 legends and nightmares. Epics and poems and songs had been written about her, so many that some even believed she was just a myth. But here was the dream, the nightmare, made flesh. This could work to your advantage. You can get the answers you need right here, right now.
Go back to Otterlin in a matter of days. Just breathe.
Breathing, as it turned out, was rather hard when the queen who had been known to drive men to madness for amusement was observing every flicker of her throat. That owl perched on Maeve's chair,
fae or true beast,
was watching her too. Its talons were curled around the back of the chair, digging into the wood. It was somewhat absurd, though. Maeve holding court in this half-rotted office, at a desk stained with the word knew what. Gods, the fact that Maeve was seated at a desk. She should be in some ethereal glen surrounded by bobbing will-o'-the-wisps and maidens dancing to lutes and harps, reading the wheeling stars like they were poetry. Not here. Selena bowed low. She supposed she should have gotten on her knees, but she already smelled awful, and her face was likely still torn and bruised from her brawling in Vera's. As Selena rose, Maeve remained smiling faintly. A spider with a fly in its web. I suppose that with a proper bath you'll look a good deal like your mother. No exchanging pleasantries, then. Maeve was going right for the throat. She could handle it. She could ignore the pain and terror to get what she wanted. So Selena smiled just as faintly and said, Had I known who I would be meeting, I might have begged my escort for time to freshen up. She didn't feel bad for one heartbeat about throwing Rowan to the lions. Maeve's obsidian eyes flicked to Rowan, who still leaned against the door. She could have sworn there was approval in the Fae Queen's smile, as if the grueling travel were a part of this plan, too. But why? Why get her off kilter? I'm afraid I must bear the blame for the pressing pace, Maeve said. Though I suppose he could have bothered to at least find you a pool to bathe in along the way. The Queen of Phaedon lifted an elegant hand, gesturing to the warrior. Prince Rowan.
Prince?
She swallowed the urge to turn to him. Is from my sister Mora's bloodline. He is my nephew of sorts, and a member of my household. An extremely distant relation of yours. There is some ancient ancestry linking you. Another move to get her on uneven footing. You don't say. Perhaps that wasn't the best reply. She should probably be on the floor, groveling for answers. And she had a feeling she'd likely get to that point very, very soon. But you must be wondering why it is I asked Prince Rowan to bring you here, Maeve mused. For Nehemia, she'd play this game. Selena bit her tongue hard enough to keep her god's damned smart-ass mouth shut. Maeve placed her white hands on the desk. I have been waiting a long, long while to meet you. And as I do not leave these lands, I could not see you. Not with my eyes, at least. The queen's long nails gleamed in the light. There were legends whispered over fires about the other skin Maeve wore. No one had lived to tell anything beyond shadows and claws and a darkness to devour your soul. They broke my laws, you know. Your parents disobeyed my commands when they eloped. The bloodlines were too volatile to be mixed, but your mother promised to let me see you after you were born. Maeve cocked her head, eerily similar to the owl behind her. It would seem that in the 8 years after your birth, she was always too busy to uphold her vow. If her mother had broken a promise, if her mother had kept her from Maeve, it had been for a damn good reason. A reason that tickled at the edges of Selena's mind, a blur of memory. But now you are here, Maeve said, seeming to come closer without moving. And a grown woman. My eyes across the sea have brought me such strange, horrible stories of you. From your scars and steel,
I wonder whether they are indeed true. Like the tale I heard over a year ago, that an assassin with Ash River eyes was spotted by the Horned Lord of the North in a wagon bound for...
Enough!
Selena glanced at Rowan, who was listening intently, as if this was the first he was hearing of it. She didn't want him knowing about Endovir. Didn't want that pity.
I know my own history.
She flashed Rowan a glare that told him to mind his own business. He merely looked away, bored again. Typical immortal arrogance. Selena faced Maeve, tucking her hands into her pockets.
I'm an assassin.
Yes. A snort from behind, but she didn't dare take her eyes off Maeve. And your other talents? Maeve's nostrils flared, scenting. What has become of them?
Like everyone else on my continent, I haven't been able to access them.
Maeve's eyes twinkled, and Selena knew that Maeve could smell the half-truth.
You are not on your continent anymore, Maeve purred.
Run.
Every instinct roared with the word. She had a feeling that the eye of Elena would have been no use, but she wished she had it anyway. Wished the dead queen were here, for that matter. Rowan was still at the door, but if she was fast, if she outsmarted him... A flash of memory blinded her, bright and uncontrollable, unleashed by the instinct begging her to flee. Her mother had rarely let Fae into their home, even with her heritage. A few trusted ones were allowed to live with them, but any Fae visitors had been closely monitored, and for the duration of their stay... Selena had been sequestered in the family's private chambers. She'd always thought it was overprotective, but now...
Show me.
Maeve whispered with a spider smile.
Run. Run!
She could still feel the burn of blue wildfire exploding out of her in that demon realm. Still see Kaol's face as she lost control of it. One wrong move... One wrong breath, and she could have killed him and Fleetfoot. The owl rustled its wings, the wood groaning beneath its talons, and the darkness in Maeve's eyes spread, reaching. There was a faint pulse in the air, a throbbing against her blood. A tapping, then a razor-sharp slicing against her mind, as if Maeve were trying to cleave open her skull and peer inside, pushing. Testing. Tasting. Fighting to keep her breathing steady, Selena positioned her hands within easy reach of her blades as she pushed back against the claws in her mind. Maeve let out a low laugh, and the pressure in her head ceased.
Your mother hid you from me for years, Maeve said.
She and your father always had a remarkable talent for knowing when my eyes were searching for you.
Such a rare gift, the ability to summon and manipulate flame. So few exist who possess more than an ember of it, fewer still who can master its wildness.
And yet your mother wanted you to stifle your power, though she knew that I only wanted you to submit to it. Selena's breath burned her throat. Another flicker of memory, of lessons not about starting fires, but putting them out. Maeve went on.
Look how well that turned out for them.
Selena's blood froze. Every self-preserving instinct went right out of her head.
And where were you 10 years ago?
She spoke so low, from so deep in her shredded soul, that the words were barely more than a growl. Maeve angled her head slightly.
I do not take kindly to being lied to.
The snarl on Selena's face faltered, dropped right into her gut. Aid had never come for Terrison from the Fae, from Wendlin,
And it was all because...
I do not have more time to spare you, Maeve said, so let me...